on that note. Frilich and Rosh Chodesh Adar to everyone. Today, we continue with our study of the Rambam. Last week, we examined, in context of his commentary to the Mishnah, the 13 principles of faith, in particular, which we have here, and they're on the board. And we spent basically the entire class last time summarizing, analyzing, considering the various aspects of these famed principles. And today what I'd like to do is to move our discussion forward.
And fix the door on the list.
Right. To move our discussion forward by firming up or completing our discussion of the Rambam's introduction to the Mishnah, and then we'll segue to his Sefer HaMitzvot, and then at least begin our consideration of his Mishneh Torah, his Halachic compendium. We'll then move toward, we'll complete that next class, and then move toward the Moreh Nevuchim and the letters of the Rambam. So probably two more classes after today, and then we will have essentially finished up our discussion of the Golden Age of Spain. Remember, the Rambam is at the tail end of this period, born in 1035 or 1038, and again expelled, essentially. That period comes to an end at 1147, with the rise of the Almohads, so this is really the closing of that period. At that point, we'll then move on to Christian Spain, and then eventually we'll come back to Ashkenaz, to France, Germany, etc., at a later point. The point I wanted to touch on, or to go into a little bit more depth on in the Rambam's introduction to the Mishnah is, as part of his larger commentary to the Mishnah, is his basic philosophy or theory as to the basis for halakha, for Torah Sheba'al Peh. Remember, this is his introduction to the Mishnah, and therefore his introduction to the authority of the Mishnah. And the Rambam essentially offers five categories, and we're going to consider them, and we're going to compare and contrast them to another of other systems. We're actually going to be looking at just three of his five, but we're going to consider them. These photocopies are taken not directly from the Rambam, but just for convenience sake, are taken from a recent book it's an outstanding book. It's one that I really very much enjoyed, written by Professor Moshe Halbertal. Professor Halbertal is an outstanding ethicist and philosopher in Israel today, a fascinating writer and a very interesting thinker. He's written a code of ethics for Tzahal. So he's very much involved in that kind of work. I believe he's been involved at activity in first steps toward writing a constitution for the state of Israel, which, as you can imagine, is a near impossibility, which is a very kind and mild way of putting it. It's literally to walk into the lion's den without much of a chance of walking back out. He's been involved in a range of other things. He has written on rabbinic authority extensively. He has an interesting book on idolatry. He's a philosopher, very thoughtful and sophisticated individual. One who has spent significant time in the world of the Beit Midrash, in a more traditional learning environment, but certainly is steeped academically in that world as well. This book is simply titled Maimonides, and it is a summary, very well done, of the Rambam's thought and biography in a way that really weaves them together. And we'll explore more about his take on the Rambam, which I found to be very compelling. I think is very much accurate as we go along. But here, for sake of convenience, I've just taken his English translations of certain key excerpts from the Rambam. So this is an excerpt from the Rambam's introduction to the Mishnah. And essentially what the Rambam does here is he offers the following categories which sort of frame the halakhic corpus, at least before we come to the halakhot that are that are based on minhag or anything like that. So here we go. So he says the first component includes all halachot given to Moses at Sinai. Enjoyed the musical Adar-oriented interlude. Regarding this component, class is really almost over. Regarding this component, Maimonides states in opposition to the Gaonim, so we'll see, that anything transmitted by tradition from Sinai was never subject to controversy. The first category consists of explanations that were received from Moses, which are alluded to in scripture, may be derived derived by deductives. Reasoning, writes the Rambam, here no difference of opinion exists. Rather, if someone states, thusly I've received it, one should not question it. Further introduction to the Mishnah. So the Rambam here writes something that is far-reaching, if not, well, not remarkable. The Rambam's claim is as follows. We know that there are mitzvot that are explicit in the Torah. Those are mitzvot from Min HaTorah. Those we know about. What about the halachot lemoshe misinai, halachot that were transmitted from generation to generation? So the Rambam claims, remarkably, that those are not only authoritative and binding, but more than that, those are not subject to machloka. Not subject to debate, to dispute at all. Now,
like chukim, right?
Huh?
Like chukim.
No, but in other words, the point is as follows. In other words, when there is a transmission, right? In other words, if we claim that something is written in Chumash, it's black on white and so on, so then it is what it is. If it's explicit, then it's explicit. Honoring one's parents. We can debate the details, but the basic notion of honoring one's parents is clear cut. The point here is that even a transmission, even a halachah l'moshe mi-Sinai, which is contingent upon an accurate transmission over the course of thousands of years, even if there's a debate, right, or we might imagine a debate about such a thing, right? You'll have one record, I'll have another record. You'll have one tradition, I might have another tradition. You can imagine debate as to what exactly that original tradition was. We're talking about something that could be corrupted over the course of this extremely long period of time. So Rambam writes, there's no such thing. There's absolutely no possibility for any debate with regard to halacha l'moshe mi-Sinai. Now, this is a very surprising position because, as I say, right, it's possible to debate this. The Gaonim, who preceded the Rambam, they fiercely disputed this. Right, they never imagined such a thing. Many Gaonim say that there's a machloket with regard to halacha l'moshe mi-Sinai that happens all the time. So, this particular position, right, that the Rambam formulates is extremely far-reaching. And the Rambam goes on to say in B section, or the next section, that the only case where there can be dispute is not with regard to the halachot l'moshe mi-Sinai, but rather with regard to an exegetical question or hermeneutical issue. In other words, how do I understand, how do I apply the 13 principles of Rabbi Yishmael, for example, that we recite at the end of Korbanot every morning, how do we apply those to reading or interpreting a particular passage in Chumash such that we derive halacha from it? Right, there can be a debate, because I'll read the pasuk in one way, you read the pasuk in another way. I'll think this is legitimate kal v'chomer, you'll think it's not a legitimate kal v'chomer, and so on and so forth. We'll dispute the technicalities as to how we interpret a pasuk, but the notion that there's agreement there, the Rambam is not insistent upon. Rather, here, there can be some achloket. Right? What's driving the Rambam? What exactly is going on? So we have to take a step back. Right? Basic question comes along with the halachic system. Any revelation-based system is, how do we account for dispute? How do we account for dispute?
Count?
Account.
Account.
Right? In other words, right? This is supposed to be something that's reliable, something that, right, we can say this is accurate, this is correct. And yet at the same time, there's clearly been either a breakdown or some question that's arisen as to the veracity of at least specific details of the law. How do we grapple with that? How do we, on the one hand, maintain a traditional approach that says, yes, this is binding and this is authentic, and yet allow for the possibility of debate? And this is not a small matter. This is really problematic. People have been distressed and disturbed in this question for literally thousands of years. I mean, you're telling me, oh, this is clearly the case, and yet you open up a page of Gemara, and Abaye and Rava and Rabbi Meir and Rabbi Huda, they're arguing in every single page of the Talmud. Well, if they're arguing in every single page of the Talmud, so then how do we know any of it is true? And how do we know the basic core foundations of our faith are accurate? These are real questions, and there are different answers and sort of approaches that have been developed over the course of time. What the Rambam and the Gaonim do is they take two fundamentally different approaches to this issue. Essentially, what the Gaonim are arguing is that, yeah, there was originally one full, complete transmission of the tradition. It was intact. It included everything. This is a basic foundational question. What exactly did God tell Moshe Rabbeinu at Har Sinai? Did he tell him everything, or did he tell him basic principles, which were then extrapolated and unpacked in a sophisticated, intelligent, but still human kind of way? So the claim of the Gaonim was always that essentially what had happened is that God gave everything to Moses at Sinai. It was complete. It was a full transmission. What happened afterward is corruption. or questions that arose. The Halacha L'Moshe Mi-Sinai said that's where it broke down. There were debates exactly what the traditions were. Right? One said it was this tradition, one said it was that tradition, so on and so forth. And the truth is, if you look at the Gemara, that's the simple understanding. Right? The Rambam comes along and says no. Because if you claim such a thing, then essentially what you're allowing for is exactly that. You're undercutting the notion of Mesorah. Mesorah is the bedrock for every aspect of halakha. So therefore the Rambam says, no, the transmission was necessarily accurate and complete. The devil, however, was in the details of the interpretation. In other words, the Mesorah, that's correct. But now the question is, I have a pasuk. It's not a question of what God said to Moshe at some ancient point, right? Some prior point in history. Rather, the question is, what do we do now? Right? How do we understand this pasuk? That's where there's a legitimate opportunity or possibility for debate. Right? So that for the Gaonim, it's a completely different theory of halakha. God gave everything to Moshe Rabbeinu at Har Sinai, and the question is, so what do we do from there? Well, right, as things were passed down from generation to generation, we no longer had the clarity of Moshe Rabbeinu, and so there were questions that arose along the way. The Rambam says nonsense. The transmission was intact. Where the debate comes in is actually in how to understand the halakha and sort of unpack it in that way. For the Rambam, what emerges is that the rabbis have a fundamentally different kind of role to play, in a sense, than did the Gaonim. Because for the Gaonic approach to halakha and its development, essentially everything was complete. Everything was done. God gave everything to Moshe Rabbeinu Har Sinai. Our exclusive role is basically to preserve. And there was breakdown. It didn't happen perfectly, and that's why we have machloket, and that's tragic. Right? Or at minimum, it's unfortunate. For the Rambam, however, no. It's not just a job of preservation. Right? That's taken care of. And that's a given. Right? The question is on the side of interpretation. And there, the Rambam assigns a much more active or substantial role, in a sense, to the rabbis and to the humans, right, with all our frailties and all of our limitations, to really be an active partner, as it were, in interpreting the word of the divine. So the Rambam's theory of halakha, in a sense, is empowering to us, and it gives the human being a much more substantial place in terms of understanding how debate unfolded, how to account for machloket in the role that rabbis play.
So did that motivate him to write the Mishneh Torah?
It's unclear. It's fair speculation, I think. He never says, therefore, I have taken upon myself. Right. It's hard to prove. But I think, yeah, in other words, the fact that the Rambam has such as, and we'll explore this more fully, such an ambitious sort of self-concept in terms of his own ability as a person to recreate and encapsulate all of halakha, sure, I think it fits nicely with exactly. So I think that's a great point. Okay. Now, the Rambam got a lot of pushback on this. So, for example, in the 17th century, and on the right side of the second side here, you have the brackets. So, 17th century, one of the great rabbis of that time, of that period, Rav Yair Bachrach. Rav Yair Bachrach, the Chavot Yair. The Chavot Yair was the chief rabbi of Worms and the surrounding communities at that time in the 1600s. A very interesting personality who wrote many responsa. If you go to, you have to travel to Germany to do this, of course, but if you go to the ancient cemetery in Worms, his grave remains there until this very day. That graveyard contains his tombstone, that of the Maharil, who was an outstanding 15th century codifier of German halachic practice, as well as the Maharam Mirutenberg. Maharam Mirutenberg was actually buried in that cemetery in 1304. So we're talking about 711 years ago. And he actually had passed in 1290, famous story. He was captured by a local government official and imprisoned. And he refused to, I think that happened in 1283, he refused to allow his family or the community to redeem him because he felt that they would just, he felt it was prohibitive because they would just take more. This was the same issue that we have
today.
Right? It's things don't, right? Why did they change? Unbelievable. Some 14 years after his passing, his family ultimately did redeem his body.
Yeah, but he languished in jail until he died.
He died in jail.
In prison,
right.
Yeah,
he died after, I think, 7 years in the prison. Right. In 1304, he was finally put to rest properly, right. 14 years after his death.
Oh, 14 years after his death?
I believe that that's the number. I believe he died in 1290 and was buried in 1304. Mm. I actually had the opportunity. It was a very difficult trip, and I almost got very mixed feelings about it. About 10 years ago, Yeshiva University arranged a trip in partnership with an organization in Germany, which was aimed at giving strength to the burgeoning Jewish community. Probably familiar, one of the great ironies of the post-Holocaust era is that, I think it's still the case, the fastest growing Jewish community in the world, certainly was true as of 5-10 years ago, was the German Jewish community. It had 100,000 about 10 years ago, about 3 years, last time I checked, it was upwards of 200,000 Jews, Russian Jews in particular, that were being incentivized to come.
Right.
People didn't necessarily know anything about tradition, and the Holocaust didn't necessarily resonate with them in the same way that it does for many of us, because they were so distanced from any Jewish education. And the German government, for guilt or political or whatever you want to call it, they were, of course, aggressive in recruiting Jews to come and to resettle, to make a certain kind of statement. So I went on this trip. It was a challenging trip. It was an interesting trip. We spent Shabbos in the yeshiva in Berlin, which recently, a couple of years ago, had their first graduating class of smicha students. It's very emotionally fraught. It's fascinating and really complex. Anyhow, so we spent a day in Worms and went to the building that used to house Rashi's yeshiva, where Rashi came from France to Germany to Worms. It's a tiny little town, but of course that's not uncommon in our history. And we saw the ancient cemetery. So we saw the Chavot Yair, this chief rabbi of Worms, was actually one of those gravestones. I really had no idea that all these great luminaries were buried there. It was just one after
Rabbi
the other.
Rabbi Katznellenbogen, the one who was in Padua, he had moved. He was born in Worms.
Interesting.
Worms, and he moved as a young age. His family moved at a young age to Italy. Northern Italy, from there.
That's right. Okay.
So these were more luminaries than you knew about.
Wow.
From Worms.
Very nice. Thank you for that addition.
And I have a book at home. There's 65,000 descendants from Rabbi Katznellenbogen, of which I am one.
Yes, that I know.
65,000 living descendants from him.
Goodness.
Rabbi Katznellenbogen.
Wow. Remarkable. Okay, so that's, so that connection to the community there. Fascinating. He's really interesting to learn about. It's a dissertation waiting to be written as well. So, in case you're...
my spare
time. Some spare time, that's right. Okay. So the Chavot Yair, among other responsa, is highly critical of the Rambam in this regard. He wrote, for example, just one excerpt quoted here by Halbertal, "Thus Maimonides is being critical of the notion that the Rambam imagines this notion that there is never any debate whatsoever about Halacha L'Moshe Mi-Sinai, which he considers to be preposterous, essentially. He writes, "Thus Maimonides built a fortified wall around the oral law by writing that it is impossible that it be forgotten," right, with the intention of protecting the tradition, right, presumably from Karaites as well, I would add. Right? And so then Chavot Yair adds, "Though any gain was outweighed by the loss incurred by writing, that any other controversy among the sages which represent the vast majority of the oral law and virtually the entire Mishnah are not from Sinai at all." By which he means to say, not that they are not rooted in Sinai. They're, of course, rooted in Sinai, but the point is, they were not stated explicitly at Sinai. That, again, according to the Rambam, right, the Rambam makes a trade, and for the Chavot Yair, the trade is too steep. For the Rambam, he protects our tradition by saying there's no debate with regard to Halacha L'Moshe Mi-Sinai. However, at the same time, he says, God did not necessarily tell Moshe Rabbeinu every single detail at Sinai. He gave him the general principles of halacha, and it was up to the rabbis to use the hermeneutical tools given to God at Sinai to unpack and to interpret and clarify the meaning and details of the oral law. As opposed to the Gaonim, again, for whom there was tremendous machloket about the traditions, but the entirety of halacha was indeed originally given explicitly to Moshe at Sinai. He says, to me, the trade-off is not worth it, because essentially you leave the majority of halacha up to the rabbis to interpret, and that, he thinks, is not worthwhile. So sort of you're darned if you do, darned if you don't, or at minimum, there are trade-offs, right? Each perspective has a strength and a weakness. There might be a third perspective that Howard Gall unpacks in another article, but that's for another time. But you can start to get a sense as to what the stakes were and why Chavrut Yair tended to object. So that was just one important point in his introduction to the Mishnah that will help us to flesh out the Rambam's philosophy of halacha as we go along. Okay, let's leave his commentary to the Mishnah there. Let's move on now to his second major work, and this is the one of the four we'll spend the least amount of time on, and that's his Sefer HaMitzvot. The Sefer HaMitzvot, as we said, is the Rambam's compilation of his position, or his counting, of the 613 commandments, 248 positive, 365 negative commandments. The Rambam is the first authority that we know of in Jewish history, literally, to systematically count every single mitzvah. Prior to the Rambam, the time of the Gaonim, there were poems that were written. Sa'adya Gaon and others write the Bahag, Baal Halachot Gedolot, whom we learned about earlier as well. They wrote poetry, they wrote quick summaries. They weren't necessarily comprehensive. They did not necessarily include every single halacha in great detail. And they certainly did not provide a systematic treatment as to the criteria. There is more of a scientific kind of approach to what's in and what's out. What the Rambam does is he doesn't just list the mitzvot. He tells you, begins with 14 shorashim, 14 overarching principles by which he tells you the criteria when you count a mitzvah, when you do not count a mitzvah. And he goes through each one. I'm not going to go through all of them. But for example, a simple one, as he says at the outset, we think it's simple, but it's not such an obvious matter, as we'll see, is that the Rambam says, well, if it's rabbinic in nature, if it's just a rabbinic decree, that's not counted. Right? Which seems like a pretty straightforward kind of thing. In other words, for example, if the rabbis invent the mitzvah to light the Chanukiah, right, so that's a rabbinic decree, that's not a mitzvah from the Torah, so it's not count a wonderful thing to do, we're obligated to do it, but it's on the basis of rabbinic authority, it doesn't count among the 613. He counts other principles as well. He talks about what happens if a mitzvah, in its core, is repeated on numerous occasions in the Torah. Do you count that, right? There are all sorts of questions that can come up. Let's say one mitzvah has multiple aspects to it. Tefillin, is that one, is that two, right? Tzitzit has the white strings, but there's also, biblically at least, there's the tchelet as well, right? Is that one, is that two, right? The daily sacrifices in the temple. Again, right? One in the morning, one in the afternoon. How do we count? And so on and so forth. So all sorts of methodological questions that arise that the Rambam considers. As an aside, it's interesting to work this through as the commentary to the Mishnah. The Rambam wrote this originally in Judeo-Arabic. So we have it in translation. As with the Perusha Mishnah, there are better and worse translations. Unlike the Perusha Mishnah, there's essentially one recension of the Sefer HaMitzvot. So we don't have multiple texts that were translated into other languages, such as Hebrew, from the original Judeo-Arabic, from different stages in the Rambam's own recension of the work, that we don't have here. But we certainly do have the issues that come up in terms of the translation. How's that laugh? Why does one second? Thinking. Okay, let's start with this. Why does the Rambam write this work? Right? The Rambam didn't just kind of write books for the fun of it. That wasn't the Rambam style. Why did he write this work? Why did he write his commentary to the Mishnah? And how does it relate to his other works as well? So Habertad points out, he's far from the first and certainly far from the last. It's a salient point, but it's a crucial point in the thought of the Rambam. It seems pretty clear the Rambam was not writing an isolated work. In fact, if you take a look at the way that the Rambam is printed, so if you look here, I have a copy of the Mishnah Torah, and the Sefer HaMitzvot, that enumeration of the Mitzvot actually appears together with, integrated with his Mishnah Torah. So the Mishnah Torah starts with the Sefer HaMitzvot, and then runs through the 14 different volumes of the Mishnah Torah.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you a question about the what you just said.
Yeah, go ahead.
I know one of the machlokas between him and Ramban Mm-hmm. Is that is whether to include Yishuv Eretz Yisrael as one of the 613 mitzvot?
Yeah, right.
So I know there's a lot written on mm-hmm. why he didn't include it.
Right.
So I just thought you might want to comment on that.
Sure. Does it fit into one of his larger mythological principles? It may or may not. There are different interpretations as to the Rambam meant, and that's to some extent dependent on your own philosophy with regard to the land of Israel. So, for example, there were those who claim, well, there simply is no there's no mitzvah, which is difficult to read in the Gemara, but a possibility. There are those who claim the opposite. Rav Kook, for example, insists that even the Rambam certainly agrees that there is a biblical obligation to settle the land of Israel.
Yeah, it says Gur Ba'aretz Hazot. I mean, it says it literally.
Right.
It's right in the Chumash. Right.
But there might be a difference between, because we know that, but in a technical halachic sense, I couldn't agree more, but in a technical halachic sense, if it's not stated after Sinai, it's not binding as a mitzvah in the technical sense. So it could be this is an overarching Jewish value that everyone should strive toward, but if you ask him technically, is it on the list, right. Maybe it wouldn't appear there. Rav Kook's claim is, in a sense, it actually does. It is included in the list, but his belief is that
this is Abraham Kook, or
yeah, the father.
Yeah.
So Rav Kook's claim is that for the Rambam, it was such a foundational, fundamental principle, it couldn't be reduced to one of the 613. In other words, right?
Yeah, but
It's sort of a larger. It's too large or too foundational to be limited to be counted in that way. Yeah, the challenge with that is that belief in the existence of God, the Rambam counts, for example.
Right.
So it's kind of It's a little bit hard to... It's
to stretch.
Yes, it's a little bit difficult, but you see where he's trying to go. There are those who claim that the Rambam did not count mitzvot, that, for example, would not be applicable in the Messianic era or something like that. So if we claim that that it's a given that the only Jewish community will be, or something like that, it could be it's not obligatory for all generations. That's also a possibility.
That's a Haredi viewpoint, though.
Today
that would be a Haredi viewpoint.
It wouldn't be a Haredi viewpoint. In other words, there is an obligation now, but the Rambam doesn't count it as a mitzvah because le'atid lavo in the Messianic era, it will no longer be applicable in the sense that it will just be a given that everyone will be in the land of Israel.
Okay.
In which case, there's no. Okay. So it's a technicality. In other words, one of the Rambam's criteria, one of his principles, is that if it has to be relevant to the Messianic era as well, because as we learned last week, one of the fundamental principles of any mitzvah in the Torah is that it is immutable, number 9, and that includes Messianic era for the Rambam, and so any mitzvah that will be superseded by something else will not be applicable. So, for example, there are those who claim the mitzvah of Sipur Yitzhiyat Mitzrayim, the Rambam does not count, even though it's an obligation to tell the story on the night of Pesach, because it's a mitzvah that will be superseded by retelling the future redemption that will supersede the retelling of the Exodus during the Messianic era, and so therefore it's not a mitzvah that. So that's not a way of downplaying the importance of Yitzhiyat Mitzrayim, it's just to say that it won't be applicable in the Messianic era, and therefore it's not counted. So that could be another possibility here as well. So why does the Rambam write this work? So just beginning to point out that that clearly the Rambam didn't just do things for fun. The Rambam, I don't know if he knew what fun was, even in this month of Adar, but certainly it didn't drive his authorial decisions. What did drive his authorial decisions is that his works were extremely systematic, not only internally within each of his writings, but externally, or in other words, across his works as well. And I was just noting that the Sefer HaMitzvot appears, in current printings at least, as the introduction to, or at the beginning of his Sefer, of his Mishneh Torah. Now, it's not exactly the introduction. It's written in a different language, after all. Right. Remember, the Sefer Mitzvah is written in Judeo-Arabic, but the Mishneh Torah is indeed written in Hebrew. We're going to get to that. So clearly, it's not truly a fully integrated single work in the original thinking and execution of the Rambam. But at the same time, it is fair to say, and it is pretty clear, that these are very much organically connected works. And in fact, if you take a look at the next excerpt, it's on page 108, in the photocopy, this is a an excerpt from his introduction to the Sefer HaMitzvot, as we're discussing now. He writes as follows: "When I directed my thoughts toward this end, I contemplated how this work should be divided and arranged. It then became obvious to me that the best division would be to do it by groups of laws in lieu of the tractates of the Mishnah. And to that end, I realized that I needed to first enumerate all of the commandments, positive and negative, in the introduction to the work, so that the divided book would still incorporate all of them, and no commandment would remain without a discussion of all its laws. This is all to make sure that there is nothing I do not talk about. If I include everything in the enumeration of the commandments, I will be secure and protected from this," from the introduction to his Sefer HaMitzvot. So the Rambam here is doing is he's describing his intention in writing Sefer HaMitzvot immediately prior to his authoring the Mishneh Torah. And what the Rambam seems to be saying is as follows: that really what the Sefer HaMitzvot is, and even what the Perush HaMishnah originally was not a standalone work, but rather a way into, a bridge to the topic or the his project of summarizing the entirety of Torah Sheba'al Peh. So in other words, what the Rambam is trying to do is as follows. The Rambam believes that systematically, if his intention in his Mishneh Torah is to encapsulate the entirety of Torah Sheba'al Peh, so he needs to begin by starting with Torah Sheba'al Peh, with an overview of the Torah Sheba'al Peh, and then unpack it systematically so that he misses nothing. Now, what the Rambam starts off doing, his first younger project was Perush HaMishnah, which he thought, well, if I'm summarizing Torah Sheba'al Peh, what better place to start with than, right, than Torah Sheba'al Peh, than Shas, Shisha Sidrei Mishnah. The Rambam becomes a little bit older and a little bit wiser. He says, you know what, scrap that, but in terms of serving as an entree to Mishneh Torah, I actually have to write yet another work as an introduction to his Mishneh Torah. Because actually, really the foundation for all mitzvot is not so much Mishnayo and Shas, but rather is the 613 commandments. If I start with the mitzvot, everything ultimately branches out from there. So what I need to do in order to write the Mishneh Torah properly, what I need to do is to start with a summary of the mitzvot. Or in order to write my summary of the mitzvot, I have to first figure out what are the criteria for the counting of the mitzvot. If I want to figure out the criteria for the counting of the mitzvot, I have to figure out what are biblical, what are rabbinic, what are what you called halachah Moshe Mitzinai earlier. Let me summarize all of those. Then I can in turn write my Sefer HaMitzvot. Once I have my Sefer HaMitzvot, I'll use that as my skeleton, right, essentially, as my outline, as it were, for the halachic compendium of Mishneh Torah.
It's interesting you should use the word skeleton, because yeah. I believe that the I know the 365 mitzvot that are positive,
yes,
right, are correspond with the days of the year, but the 200 and whatever it was, 278 or whatever number,
248
correspond with the bones in the body,
right?
Which is the number of bones in the body.
So. Yes, it is. It is. It was an unintentional but well done pun.
I picked up on it.
I appreciate that. But you should just know it's also 365. It's both, right? It's according to tradition. It's 248 limbs, yes, but it's also 365 sinews. The Gidim.
Oh, okay.
And if you take if you listen,
but not the days of the year.
It's both.
It's both. Okay.
In different traditions. Although it's not perfect, right, because it's the days of the solar year calendar, not
true.
The days of the lunar year. Lunar year is 11.
But I mean, round off. I mean, it averages 365 days. You know,
if you take the
75 and a quarter,
because it needs to accord, right?
Right.
That's correct. It's actually, just as an aside, it's interesting. You'll notice this when you hear Mishaberach for Cholim. I say cholim specifically, not for cholot. According to rabbinic tradition, those are the number of limbs and sinews in a male body. And females apparently have a different count, which whatever its significance is, or not, is different. So that's why if you listen carefully in shuls where they make different mishaberach for cholim and cholot, they'll do cholim will have ramach ivarehem ushesagidehem. If you listen on Shabbat morning, you'll hear that. But in mishaberach for cholot, they won't have that because apparently, whatever other count there is, it's not this count. And that's why there are those who are hesitant to combine them, because according to tradition, and it's a... we'll weigh on that another time. But that's where it comes from. That's where it comes up on a regular basis. You can see it's there as well. Okay. And I think there's a deeper idea there, right? There's this correspondence between spiritual health and physical health, and so on. Not all that different from what the Rambam describes, as we saw Well, he has a lens.
I mean, he's looking through the he's looking at it through the lens of a physician.
That's right. Yeah. So it's discussed. So, I don't know if you're for that one, but we discuss Shmona Prakim. The Rambam does exactly that. So, which is quite fascinating. So essentially, then the Sefer HaMitzvot is a remarkable work. It's a transformative work in its own right because no one had systematically counted the mitzvot before. But for the Rambam, it's really just an introduction. It's just his entree to the main course, which is really his count of the Mishnah Torah proper, which is a pretty remarkable kind of thing. Now, it needs to be pointed out as well that, and this goes to the issue I mentioned, that the Rambam, one of the Rambam's principles for counting, one of his criteria, should not be a rabbinic commandment. Now, as I said it, I said this seems pretty obvious. It seems like a pretty basic one. But the truth is, the Rambam here was pushing back against the Gaonic tradition. If you take a look at these quasi-counts that you find among the Gaonim, for example, the Baal Halachot Gedolot, the Bahag in particular, comes under tremendous scrutiny from the Rambam. I would say he comes under fire, really, from the Rambam for having counted the mitzvot d'Rabbanan among his list of the biblical commandments. So, when it comes to lighting the Hanukkah candles, or it comes to reading the Megillah, Megillah Esther, comes to building or to setting an Eruv aside so that the community can carry on Shabbat, washing your hands, so on and so forth. These rabbinic enactments are traditionally seven. These positive rabbinic enactments, the Hag actually counts them as mitzvot. And the Rambam says this is a total nonsense. What's going on over here? Why is this so significant for the Rambam? It's just another detail. Why did the Bahag think differently? What exactly is happening here? Also very interesting to note that there is a sort of a circular problem regarding which the Rambam and the Ramban, Maimonides and Nachmanides, the Ramban we're going to come to a little bit later in Christian's Bane. The Ramban is highly critical of the Rambam in this regard. There's another debate with regard to the status or stature that makes rabbinic law binding. Because right? What's the problem? Well, there are as a basic problem, which is why is it that rabbinic law is binding? And if the answer is that the Torah says so, then what differentiates rabbinic law from biblical law? All rabbinic law ultimately is biblical law. There really is no difference between them. Which is fine, except that we tend to think of rabbinic law as lesser or different. There are different rules that govern mitzvot midrabanan than mitzvot midoraitas. For example, a matter of doubt. The basic principles that a suffik deoraita luchuma, that if it's a doubt with regard to a biblical matter, we're stringent. Suffik derabanan lakula, if it's with regard to a rabbinic matter, so then we tend toward leniency. But if all derabanans are really deoraitas, right? Because right, the Torah says you have to listen to the rabbis, particularly the pasuk lo tasur, which says that you shall not deviate from that which the rabbis tell you, right or left. Right, lo tasur nadavar sheyom lecha yaminu small. Right, and Chazal understand say even if they tell you about that which is left that it's right, and even that about that which is right that it's left. So rabbinic law is binding even when it doesn't seem comprehensible to us. So we go so far. So then what exactly is the difference between a mitzvah deoraita and mitzvah derabanan? And in fact, the Rambam and the Ramban debated this. The Rambam claims that that they're really very different kinds of things, and the Ramban is highly critical of him. Says, you know, well, what does that mean, right? How do you understand that? So, what exactly is the Rambam trying to do? So, what could well be, it seems quite plausible, is what the Rambam is trying to do. Really, is this goes to the question we were discussing earlier about the Rambam attempting to sort of stratify, right, each of these different levels of authority and really create clear lines of authority in that way. So if you take a look at the Rambam here, the next excerpt on page 117, so the Rambam in his second Shoresh of the 14 principles that precede his count of the mitzvot, Ram writes as follows: since this is the case, it cannot be said of everything that the sages derived using one of the 13 hermeneutical principles that it was said to Moses at Sinai. Yet it also cannot be said that everything found in the Talmud that is based on one of the 13 principles is rabbinic, for it is possible that it represents a received interpretation. The way to distinguish it thus: anything that is not made explicit in the Torah, but which is derived in the Talmud from one of the 13 principles, if the sages explicitly stated that this part of the corpus of Torah or that it is deoraita, then it is worthy of being enumerated. For the bearers of the tradition have said it is deoraita. If they have not explained or stated thus explicitly, then it is rabbinic. This is a key point in the thought of the Rambam that also deserves elaboration. So just to mention one more point here that really brings the Rambam together. The Rambam claims, and this is part of the critique of the Rambam, and also the Ramban and others are highly critical of him for this as well. The Rambam invents a category that he calls Divrei Sofrim, words of the rabbis. Now, what does it mean something is from the words of the rabbis? If I were to ask you, if someone uses the term Divrei Sofrim, which of these different levels does that refer to?
Divrei Sofrim?
Yeah, words of the Sofrim, which are essentially the rabbis.
That sounds the Rabbanan.
Yeah, so I would think that that's a reference to the rabbinic edicts. And in fact, in general tradition, that's exactly how the terminology is used. The Rambam doesn't seem to use it in that way. The Rambam seems to claim that, or uses the term Divrei Sofrim to refer to anything that was derived by the rabbis using the 13 principles of hermeneutical interpretation that we mentioned earlier. Those are Divrei Sofrim. Not because those rules are binding on the basis of the rabbis say so, although that's true to some extent. But the point is, it was only due to the rabbis' interpretation that we came to understand the Torah itself in that way. So it's not that the rabbis invented this category or they legislated it, but rather, it was due to rabbinic interpretation, Divrei Sofrim, that it's binding. The Rambam says this category, Divrei Sofrim, is not counted among the list of the mitzvot. If it was only due to the 13 hermeneutical principles, right, the Rambam says that's something different. That's called Divrei Sofrim. And the Rambam comes back to this time and time again, and everyone scratches their heads like, what does Divrei Sofrim mean? That means rabbinic edicts. What are you talking about? And so around and around they go. So this is something that comes up really all the time on a very regular basis. So where this comes in is, again, you start to see that the Rambam is extremely sensitive here, and he seems to try to say, basically what I think he's trying to do is to sort of draw a fence. And the Rambam's saying, there's this other thing, in other words, Divrei Sofrim, those hermeneutical principles, remember, the Rambam said those are or are not subject to debate.
Oh, you're asking?
For the Rambam, yeah. Hermeneutical principles. Divrei Sofrim. Right, what was subject to debate for the Rambam and what was not? Could you debate a halacha l'Moshe Mitzrayim?
No.
Could you debate a hermeneutical principle?
No.
Right? That you could for the Rambam.
You could.
No. That you could for the Rambam. Right? Because what's the Rambam trying to do? The Rambam is trying to do, because remember, Torah Shavuot is under attack at the time of the Rambam, right? Karaites, etc. So what the Rambam is doing is trying to sort of, it would seem, to sort of carve out this pristine, untouched kernel, right? The sort of the essential kernel of the Torah. And what does that constitute? What does that include? It includes, essentially, that which is explicit in the Torah, or that which was explicitly transmitted by God to Moses at Sinai. And that's the key to the corpus of halakha. Anything else is sort of like a second level add-on, either because it was legislated by the rabbis, or for the Rambam, fundamentally similar, right? Or because it's subject to really the hermeneutical interpretation of the rabbis, which the Rambam says, that's Divrei Sofrim, that's subject to controversy. But if you want to preserve the corner, you know what's not subject to controversy? Those first two categories that I outlined in my commentary to the Mishnah. And you see that he's really digging in on those also in his introduction to the mitzvot. And he's saying, those are the 613. That's sort of the essence of the Torah. It's indisputable. No one, right, comes to debate any of those. Then there's sort of the second level, very important, but ultimately sort of an appendage, right, that constitutes areas that are subject to debate. And those are rabbinically driven, either because they're rabbinically legislated or because they're subject to rabbinic hermeneutical interpretation. That's sort of this added level. But you see what the Rambam is trying to do is, again, it's almost this process of preservation, of protection. He places halakha, the core of halakha, in a cocoon, and he ensures its safety. And that's really what the Rambam is trying to do. There are others who are quite unhappy, as I mentioned, the Ramban. So you take a look at page 119, the next quotation. So the Ramban has the following to say. I am aware that many other Talmudic passages contradict the master's works, the Rambam's works. For the content of the master's work is enjoyable and entirely delightful, with the exception of this rule, which uproots large mountains of Talmud and demolishes fortified walls of Gemara. For students of the Talmud, this matter is evil and bitter. Let it drown and not be spoken. The Rambam says this claim that the Divrei Sofrim are essentially rabbinic in nature and therefore ought not be counted among the 613. He says, yeah. He says, that is out. That's against the Gemara. And the Ramban goes further. Right at the bottom, he raises a conceptual objection to the Rambam. He says, as follows, such knowledge is beyond me, this notion of the Divrei Sofrim, and so on. Such knowledge is beyond me, it is lofty, I cannot attain it. The Ramban tongue-in-cheek says, I guess this is just too deep for me, right? For if we say that the hermeneutical principles that were not received from Sinai, we were not commanded to interpret and explain the Torah with them. If so, they are not true, and truth lies in the straightforward meaning of the verse, not the interpreted meaning, as mentions in the sage's dictum that a verse does not deviate from its straightforward meaning. We will thus have cut off the root of our traditional acceptance of the 13 hermeneutical principles, as well as most of the Talmud, which is founded upon them. So his claim is that even internally the Rambam doesn't make sense. If the 13 hermeneutical principles were themselves derived from the Torah, then they should not be subject to any dispute, in which case, right, the whole notion the Rambam is trying to maintain, which is that, well, these are the things that you can argue about, but everything else is that pure core of the Torah, right, that distinction ultimately collapses on top of itself. But you see what the Rambam is trying to do. So to summarize, the Rambam in his commentary to his introduction to the Mishnah and his introduction to and his criteria for the counting of the mitzvot is really trying to do is to sort of preserve this kernel, as well as then by doing so set the stage for his next work, which is going to be the Mishnah Torah. Now, the one other point that I want to add about his count of the mitzvot, we just don't have the time to go through all of this, is that the Rambam, in particular at the beginning of his count, you start to see the systematization of the Rambam. Right, because the question is, how do you count the mitzvot? In other words, not only what are the 248 positive, what are the 365 negative, and we said the Rambam outlines rules for those, what is the proper order for the counting? Which is first, which is 248th, and how do you fill in everything in between? Same for the negative commandments as well. Why would the order make a difference? That could be true as well. Well, it's interesting. The Sefer HaChinuch, one of the classic lists of mitzvot, organizes them by Parshat HaShavuot. So that, I don't know if that's conceptually significant, but it's certainly a practical kind of thing. The Rambam, at a certain point, it may or may not be, but it's very clear that he has something in mind. For example, the first mitzvah is he counts belief in the existence of God. Presumably not a coincidence that that's number one of 248. He then, number two, is Yichud Hashem.
That's also the first of the Aseret HaDibros.
That's right. Yeah, that's correct.
The belief in Hashem.
That's correct.
Ani Hashem.
Absolutely. Although then it takes a turn. Three is loving God. Right. Four is awe of God. Yirah. Five is service of God. And he goes on from there. To cleave to Torah scholars, to swear in his name, to emitz hatyodei, v'halachta b'drachav, those who were really Pearl Shear in September. Nine is sanctifying God's name, kiddush Hashem. 10 is kriyat shema. 11 is Talmud Torah. Tefillin shel Rosh, Tefillin shel Yad. Remember I said, do you count them as one or two? The Rambam counts them as separate, which is very interesting. And tzitzit is 14, mezuzah is 15, and so on and so forth. It's pretty clear that these are not just any mitzvot, that these are particularly essential or foundational mitzvot. Certainly the first, but even some of the subsequent ones. And so there's been a tremendous amount of ink spilled trying to figure out what was the Rambam trying to convey, what is the inner logic. It's very clear these are not just sort of thrown up like on a dartboard, but then what's the internal logic, especially the Rambam, who, as we'll see, was so into systematization and organization that it's clear that he has something intentional in his mind. So without going through and sort of offering one theory, just to point out in general that there's a tremendous amount of energy and time that can and has been poured into this question of what is the Rambam's internal organization. The other thing is that the Rambam's count of mitzvot can be conceptually very interesting, very significant. So, for example, when it comes to the daily sacrifices, the Rambam counts just one mitzvah. But when it comes to tefillin, interestingly enough, he counts two. Right? Which is not surprising in the sense that, right, one is the same thing two times during the day, Right? Each of the sacrifices are identical. It's a lamb that you shech and you offer in the identical fashion in the morning and the afternoon, but the Tzvon Shel Yad and the Tzvon Shel Rosh are very different kinds of things. But if you analyze the Rambam in his Mishneh Torah as well, you'll see it's not just that they're different physical actions, but that they represent very different kinds of themes. That the Tefillin Shel Yad for the Rambam is very much about our internal dedication and about our own commitment. Tefillin Shel Rosh is more about projecting that outward. Right, there are many who say along the lines of the Rambam that we cover the Tefillin Shel Yad, but the Tefillin Shel Rosh should specifically be uncovered, because one is really internal, it's a private matter, our own faith, and Tefillin Shel Rosh are more about Pe'er, they're about projecting outward to others, a sense of sharing the faith, Kiddush Hashem, and so on and so forth. So the fact that the Rambam counts two different mitzvot is not just, well, okay, count it two, mazel tov, you know, two out of 248. No, it can offer insight, and in fact, remarkable insight into what mitzvot really represent and what they're all about. So there's so much richness and depth to all of these. Okay. Then the Rambam clearly is using this as a springboard to his Mishneh Torah. Mishneh Torah, as I say, is one of, if not the most remarkable halachic work after the Talmud in our rabbinic tradition. It's that simple. It's probably, and how do you define this, or how do you what are the criteria? But if you just ask me, if you would poll Torah scholars, you know, just randomly on the street, you know, after the Mishnah and the Gemara, what is the greatest halachic work written in the, you know, 1500 years subsequent, right? I think you wouldn't have too much debate. You might hear some people saying the Shulchan Aruch, something like that, but I think you get a very solid vote in favor of the Rambam. It's just one of the most outstanding, comprehensive, ingenious works that we have. And the question is, what was the Rambam trying to do? What was this project all about? And how did he conceive this, and why did he decide to do this? We're going to have to get into this more, but just to get the conversation started, it seems very clear, and this is one of the points that Halbertam makes in his biography / intellectual history, is that the Rambam believed not only very deeply in himself, in his own capacity, but he believed that he was living at a critical, even cataclysmic moment in Jewish history. The Rambam, remember, as a young boy, right, fled. His family was kicked out. But there was all sorts of tumultuousness across the Jewish world, not only the Rambam's own young life, which clearly was the case, but all over the world. The Rambam was receiving letters from communities like Yemen and communities around the globe with false messiahs, with tremendous persecution, with terrible upheaval. Now, I'm not sure it's necessarily worse upheaval than, let's say, the Spanish Jewish community in 1492, to take just an example, or the German Jewish community during the Crusades in 1096. But for the Rambam, where he was living and when he was living, he believed that literally the Jewish people's safety and security was under tremendous threat, and not that he felt that there was a genuine threat, an existential threat to Jewish continuity, physical continuity, but what he did believe was a true threat was to the tradition of the halacha and of Torah Shabbat. That was the Rambam believed that at a time of a breakdown in our yeshivot and our educational systems and in communities, traditions would be lost and knowledge would really disappear, God forbid, forever. Time before the internet, right? Before printing, before knowledge and Sfarim were widely available, the Rambam literally felt that the future of the transmission of our tradition was up in the air. And basically what the Rambam came to conclude was that it was in his hands to save rabbinic Judaism. There's just no other way to put it. He couldn't stop our enemies. He wasn't a one-man, you know, war machine, right? So that wasn't an option for him. We didn't have the autonomy or the government structures or our standing army or anything like that in order to. So the only thing we had was, as we generally had throughout our exile, was the power of the pen. I mean, after that, what do we really have? That's pretty much it. And the brain, right? The mind and the pen.
He wasn't a Shmuel Hanagid leading the troops of Granada.
No, that was not that was not the Rambam.
Against the enemies.
It wasn't even the Rambam's own self described Mashiach. The Rambam describes the Messianic Savior as like a Bar Kokhba personality, right? Not that it was Bar Kokhba, right? But it was a warrior, a physical warrior. But that's not the Rambam. The Rambam really put all rabbinic tradition on his shoulders, and he believed that he had no choice but to encapsulate the entirety of our tradition in, well, this is one volume, before, but you get the idea, in a relatively small space. And the Rambam believed that it was on him, there was no one else alive, and that it was up to him to save our people. That's pretty much a summary of the Rambam. You can see why not everyone was so happy about this, but the Rambam was very self-aware in terms of his own intelligence, in terms of limitations of his community and of his society, and that's pretty much how the Rambam lived his own personal life, because remember, the Rambam's own traumatic experiences as a child clearly shaped dramatically, right, his self-concept and his wider conception of the community around him. Not only that, but the Rambam believed this has happened one more time, or one prior time in Jewish history, which is at the time that the Mishnah was set to writing. At the time of Roman persecutions, when Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi, right, it's about 100 some odd years after the second Beit HaMikdash is destroyed, the future of the Jewish community in Israel is all but over, right? Bar Kokhba revolt, the final major revolt, was put down back in 132 to 135 of the Common Era. It's already approaching 200, right? There's no choice. There's the fear that everything will be lost. Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi says, we've got no choice. We must set to writing what until now has been an intentionally oral tradition. He says, this is the time where we have to undo all of tradition. And for the sake of ultimately saving the tradition, we need to violate what were previously the laws and put it down to writing. So Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi becomes the model for the Rambam. So what we're going to see is that the Rambam is really, for him, a second coming, as it were, of essentially the project of the Mishnah. Are we going to see some very stark parallels between Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi's project of the Mishnah and the Rambam's project Mishnah Torah? We've already noticed one, which is the language that the Rambam chooses to use. This is the first work that we've discussed, but of these four, it's the only work which is intentionally written in pure Hebrew, right, as opposed to the Judeo-Arabic, and like, right, along the lines of what Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi did in the Mishnah. So this is the great project of the Rambam. There's so much to say. We're going to look at the introduction to the Rambam, what he was trying to do, some of his positions, the pushback that he gets, some of the in order to encapsulate all of Torah Shebaal Peh, some of the sacrifices, some might say, that the Rambam made in order to get there, some of the things that he cut out in sort of simplifying and codifying, giving you the core of the tradition. And in addition to the pushback, to actually look at the structure of this voluminous work, of this remarkable output, and get a sense as to how it's structured, what its internal logic is. It's a pleasure. Chodesh Tov to everyone. It was a pleasure.